And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Vicki Andrews, and today I'll be reading from The Butter Battle Book by Dr. Seuss. On the last day of summer, 10 hours before fall, my grandfather took me out to the wall. For a while he stood silent. Then finally he said with a very sad shake of his very old head, "As you know, on this side of the wall, we are Yeek. On the far other side of the wall live the Zooks." Then my grandfather said, "It's high time you knew of the terribly horrible thing that Zooks do. In every Zook house, and in every Zook town, every Zook eats his bread with the butter side down. But we Zooks, as you know, when we breakfast or sup, spread our bread," Grandpa said, "with the butter side up." "That's the right, honest way," Grandpa gritted his teeth, "so you can't trust a Zook who spreads bread underneath. Every Zook must be watched. He has kinks in his soul. And that's why, as a youth, I made watching my goal, watching Zooks for the Zook-watching border patrol." In those days, of course, the wall wasn't so high, and I could look any Zook square in the eye. If he dared to come close, I would give him a twitch with my tuft-tufted, prickly snickberry switch. For a while, that worked fine. All the Zooks stayed away, and our country was safe. Then, one terrible day, a very rude Zook by the name of Van Itch snuck up and slingshotted my snickberry switch. With my broken-off switch, with my head hung in chains to the chief yookaloo in great sorrow, I came. But our leader just laughed. He said, "You're not to blame, and those Zooks will be sorry they started this game. We'll dress you right up in a fancier suit. We'll give you a fancier slingshot to shoot." And he ordered the boys in his back room to figure how to build me some sort of triple sling jigger. And with my triple sling jigger, I sure felt much bigger. I marched to the wall with great vim and great vigor, right up to Van Itch with my hand on the trigger. "I'll take no more nonsense," I said with a frown, "from you Zooks who eat bread with the butter side down." Van Itch looked quite sickly. He ran off quite quickly. I'm unhappy to say he came back the next day in a spiffy new suit with a big new machine, and he snarled as he said, looking quite so mean, "You may fling those hard rocks with your triple sling jigger, but I also now have my hand on a trigger. My wonderful weapon, the jigger rock snatch'em, will fling 'em right back just as quick as you catch 'em. We'll take no more nonsense. We'll have no more gut from you Yooks who eat bread with the butter side up." "I failed, sir," I sobbed as I made my report to the chief yookaloo in the headquarters post. He just laughed. "Well, you've done nothing at all of the sort. Our slingshots have failed. That was old-fashioned stuff. Slingshots, dear boy, are not modern enough. What we need is some newfangled kind of a gun. My boys in the back room have already begun to think up a walloping whiz-zinger one. My bright boys are thinking. They're on the right track. They'll think one up quick, and we'll send you right back." And they thought up a great one. They thought up a gun called the Kickapoo Kid, which they loaded with powerful poo-a-doo powder and ants' eggs and bees' legs and dried fried corn powder. And they carefully trained a real smart dog named Daniel to serve as our country's first gun-toting spaniel. Then Daniel, the Kickapoo Spaniel, and I marched back toward the wall with our heads held up high, while everyone cheered and their cheers filled the sky. "Fight! Fight for the butter side up! Do or die!" Well, we didn't do, and we didn't quite die, but we sure did get worsted, poor Daniel and I. Then it was there too, and said the old pig. The boys in my back room invented this rig called the eight-nozzled elephant-toted boom blitz. It shoots high-explosive sour cherry stone tips and will put your dumb kickapoo kid on the fritz. Poor Daniel and I were scared out of our wits. Once again by then it, I was dusted and beat. Once again I limped home from the wall in defeat. I dragged and I sagged and my spirits were low, as low as I thought that they ever could go. When I heard a boom-ba and a diddly-doo, and our butter-up band marched up over the hill. But Chief Yookaroo had sent them to meet me, along with the right-side-up song girls to greet me. They sang, oh, be faithful, believe in thy butter. And they lifted my spirits right out of the gutter. My boy, smiled at Chief Yookaroo, we've just voted and made you a general. You've been promoted. Your pretty new uniform's ready. Get in it. The big war is coming. You're going to begin it. And what's more, this time you're certain to win it. My boys in the back room have finally found how. Just wait till you see what they've puttered up now. In their great new machine, you'll fly over that wall and clobber those butter-down zooks one and all. Those boys in the back room sure knew how to putter. They made me a thing called the Utterly Sputter, and I jumped aboard with my heart all aflutter and steered towards the land of the upside-down butter. Now, this machine was so modern, so frightfully new, that no one knew quite exactly just what it would do, but it had several faucets that sprinkled blue goo, which somehow would sprinkle the zooks as I flew and gum up that upside-down butter they chew. I was racing pell-mell when I heard a voice yell, if you sprinkle a zook, you'll get sprinkled as well. Then it had a sputter exactly like mine and yelled, my blue goer is working just fine, and I'm here to say that if zooks can do zooks, you'd better forget it. Cause zooks can do zooks. I flew right back home, and as you might have guessed, I was downright despondent, disturbed, and depressed. And I saw, just as soon as I stepped back on land, so were all of the girls in the butter-up band. The chief drum major, Miss Yuki Ann, too, said, that was a pretty sour flight that you flew, and the chief Yukaroo has been looking for you. I raced to his office. The place was a sight. Have no fear, said the chief. Everything is all right. Our bright vacuum boys have been brighter than bright. They set up a gadget that's newer than new. It is filled with mysterious moo lacquer moo and can blow all those zooks clear to Salamagoo. They've invented the Bitsy Big Boy Boomeroo. He just run to the wall like a nice little man. Drop this bomb on the zooks just as quick as you can. I have ordered all zooks to stay safe underground while the Bitsy Big Boy Boomeroo is around. As I race to that wall with the bomb in my hand, I noticed that every last zook in our land was obeying the Chief Yookaroo's grim command. They were all bravely marching with banners aflutter down the hole for their country and right-side-up butter. That's when Grandfather found me. He grabbed me. He said, you should be down there, too, but you're up here instead. But perhaps this is all for the better somehow. You'll see me make history. Right here and right now. Grandpa leapt up that wall with a lopulous leap, and he cleared his hoarse throat with a bopulous beat. He screamed, here's the end of that terrible town full of zooks who eat bread with the butter side down. And at that very instant, we heard the clop, clop of feet on the wall. And all Sam Itch clopped up. The boys in his back room had made him one, too. And his sister was another big boy, Boomeroo.
I'll blow you, he yelled, into pork and wee beans. I'll butterfly up you to small smithereens.
Grandpa, I shouted, be careful. He's gonna drop it. Will you? Or will he?
Be patient, said Grandpa. We'll see. We will see. You've been listening to the story, The Butter Battle Book by Dr. Seuss, published by Random House. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Emier. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tonello, and I'm Vicki Andrews.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Bill McDermott. Today I'll be reading from the book Many Moons by Jane Serber. Once upon a time, in a kingdom by the sea, there lived a little princess named Lenore. She was 10 years old, going on 11. One day, Lenore fell ill of a surfeit of raspberry tarts and took to her bed. The royal physician came to see her and took her temperature and felt her pulse and made her stick out her tongue. The royal physician was worried. He sent for the king, Lenore's father, and the king came to see her. I will get you anything your heart desires, the king said. Is there anything your heart desires? Yes, said the princess. I want the moon. If I can have the moon, I will be well again. Now the king had a great many wise men who always got for him anything he wanted. So he told his daughter that she could have the moon. Then he went to the throne room and pulled a bell cord, 3 long pulls and a short pull. And presently the Lord High Chamberlain came into the room. The Lord High Chamberlain was a large, fat man who wore thick glasses which made his eyes seem twice as big as they really were. This made the Lord High Chamberlain seem twice as wise as he really was. I want you to get the moon, said the king. The Princess Lenore wants the moon. If she can have the moon, she will get well again. The moon, exclaimed the Lord High Chamberlain, his eyes widening. This made him look 4 times as wise as he really was. Yes, the moon, said the king. M-O-O-N, moon. Get it, tonight, tomorrow at the latest. The Lord High Chamberlain wiped his forehead with a handkerchief and then blew his nose loudly. I have got a great many things for you in my time, Your Majesty, he said. It just happens that I have with me a list of the things I have got for you in my time. He pulled a long scroll of parchment out of his pocket. Let me see now. He glanced at the list, frowning. I've got ivory apes and peacocks, rubies, opals, and emeralds, black orchids, pink elephants, and blue poodles, gold bugs, scarabs, and flies in amber, hummingbirds' tongues, angels' feathers, and unicorns' horns, giants, midgets, and mermaids, frankincense, ambergris, and myrrh, troubadours, minstrels, and dancing women, a pound of butter, 2 dozen eggs, and a sack of sugar. Sorry, my wife wrote that in there. I don't remember any blue poodles, said the king. It says blue poodles right here on the list, and they are checked off with a little check mark, said the Lord High Chamberlain. So there must have been blue poodles. You just forget. Never mind the blue poodle, said the king. What I want now is the moon. I have sent as far as Samarkand and Araby and Zanzibar to get things for you, your majesty, said the Lord High Chamberlain. But the moon is out of the question. It is 35,000 miles away, and it is bigger than the room the princess lies in. Furthermore, it's made of molten copper. I cannot get the moon for you. Blue poodles, yes. The moon, no. The king flew into a rage and told the Lord High Chamberlain to leave the room and to send the royal wizard to the throne room. The royal wizard was a little thin man with a long face. He wore a high red peaked hat covered with silver stars and a long blue robe covered with golden owls. His face grew very pale when the king told him that he wanted the moon for his little daughter and that he expected the royal wizard to get it. I have worked a great deal of magic for you in my time, your majesty, said the royal wizard. As a matter of fact, I just happen to have in my pocket a list of the wizardries I have performed for you. He drew a paper from the deep pocket of his robe. It begins, Dear Royal Wizard, I am returning herewith the so-called philosopher's stone which you claim... No, that isn't it. The royal wizard brought a long scroll of parchment from another pocket of his robe. Here it is, he said. Now let's see. I have squeezed blood out of turnips for you and turnips out of blood. I have produced rabbits out of silk hats and silk hats out of rabbits. I have conjured up flowers, tambourines, and doves out of nowhere and nowhere out of flowers, tambourines, and doves. I have brought you divining rods, magic wands, and crystal spheres in which to behold the future. I have compounded philtres, unguents, and potions to cure heartbreak, surfeit, and ringing in the ears. I have made you my own special mixture of wolfbane, nightshade, and eagle's tears to ward off witches, demons, and things that go bump in the night. I have given you 7-league boots, the golden touch, and a cloak of invisibility. It didn't work, said the king. The cloak of invisibility didn't work. Yes, it did, said the royal wizard. No, it didn't, said the king. I kept bumping into things, the same as ever. The cloak is supposed to make you invisible, said the royal wizard. It's not supposed to keep you from bumping into things. All I know is I kept bumping into things, said the king. The royal wizard looked at his list again. I got you, he said. Horns from Elfland, sand from the Sandman, and gold from the Rainbow. Also a spool of thread, a paper of needles, and a lump of beeswax. Sorry, those are things my wife wrote down for me to get her. What I want you to do now, said the king, is to get me the moon. The Princess Honor wants the moon, and when she gets it, she will be well again. Nobody can get the moon, said the royal wizard. It is 150,000 miles away, and it is made of green cheese, and it is twice as big as this palace. The king flew into another rage and sent the royal wizard back to his cave. Then he rang a gong and summoned the royal mathematician. The royal mathematician was a bald-headed, nearsighted man with a skull cap on his head and a pencil behind each ear. He wore a black suit with white numbers on it. I don't want to hear a long list of all the things you figured out for me since 1907, the king said to him. I want you to figure out right now how to get the moon for the Princess Lenore. When she gets the moon, she will be well again. I'm glad you mentioned all the things I figured out for you since 1907, said the royal mathematician. It so happens that I have a list of them with me. He pulled a long scroll of parchment out of his pocket and looked at it. Now let me see. I have figured out for you the distance between the horns of a dilemma, night and day, and A and Z. I have computed how far is up, how long it takes to get away, and what becomes of gone. I have discovered the length of the sea serpent, the price of the priceless, and the square of the hippopotamus. I know where you are when you are at 6 and 7, how much is you have to make an R, and how many birds you can catch with the salt in the ocean. 187,796,132. If it would interest you to know, there aren't that many birds, said the king. I didn't say there were, said the royal mathematician. I said if there were. I don't want to hear about 700 million imaginary birds, said the king. I want you to get the moon for the Princess Lenore. The moon is 300,000 miles away, said the royal mathematician. It is round and flat like a coin, only it is made of asbestos, and it is half the size of the kingdom. Furthermore, it's pasted on the sky. Nobody can get the moon. The king flew into still another rage and sent the royal mathematician away. Then he rang for the court jester. The jester came bounding into the throne room in his motley and his cap and bells and sat at the foot of the throne. "What can I do for you, Your Majesty?" asked the court jester. "Nobody can do anything for me," said the king mournfully. "The Princess Lenore wants the moon, and she cannot be well till she gets it, but nobody can get it for her. Every time I ask anybody for the moon, it gets larger and farther away. There's nothing you can do for me except play on your lute. Something sad." "How big do they say the moon is?" asked the court jester. "And how far away?" "The Lord High Chamberlain says it's 35,000 miles away and bigger than the Princess Lenore's room," said the king. "The royal wizard says it's 150,000 miles away and twice as big as this palace. The royal mathematician says it's 300,000 miles away and half the size of this kingdom." The court jester strummed on his lute for a little while. "They are all wise men," he said, "and so they must all be right. If they are all right, then the moon must be just as large and as far away as each person thinks it is. The thing to do is to find out how big the Princess Lenore thinks it is, and how far away." "I never thought of that," said the king. "I will go and ask her, Your Majesty," said the court jester, and he crept softly into the little girl's room. The Princess Lenore was awake, and she was glad to see the court jester, but her face was very pale and her voice very weak. "Have you brought the moon to me?" she asked. "Not yet," said the court jester, "but I will get it for you right away. How big do you think it is?" "It's just a little smaller than my thumbnail," she said. "For when I hold my thumbnail up at the moon, it just covers it." "And how far away is it?" asked the court jester. "It's not as high as the big tree outside my window," said the princess, "for sometimes it gets caught in the top branches." "It will be very easy to get the moon for you," said the court jester. "I will climb the tree tonight when it gets caught in the top branches and bring it to you." Then he thought of something else. "What is the moon made of, princess?" he asked. "Oh," she said, "it's made of gold, of course, silly." The court jester left the Princess Lenore's room and went to see the royal goldsmith. He had the royal goldsmith make a tiny round golden moon, just a little smaller than the thumbnail of the Princess Lenore. Then he had him string it on a golden chain so the princess could wear it around her neck. "What is this thing I have made?" asked the royal goldsmith when he had finished it. "You have made the moon," said the court jester. "That is the moon." "But the moon," said the royal goldsmith, "is 500,000 miles away and is made of bronze and is round like a marble." "That's what you think," said the court jester as he went away with the moon. The court jester took the moon to the Princess Lenore, and she was overjoyed. The next day she was well again and could get up and go out in the gardens to play. But the king's worries were not yet over. He knew that the moon would shine in the sky again that night, and he did not want the Princess Lenore to see it. If she did, she would know that the moon she wore on a chain around her neck was not the real moon. So the king sent for the Lord High Chamberlain and said, "We must keep the Princess Lenore from seeing the moon when it shines in the sky tonight. Think of something." The Lord High Chamberlain tapped his forehead with his finger thoughtfully and said, "I know just the thing. We can make some dark glasses for the Princess Lenore. We can make them so dark that she will not be able to see anything at all through them. Then she will not be able to see the moon when it shines in the sky." This made the king very angry, and he shook his head from side to side. "If she wore dark glasses, she would bump into things," he said, "and then she would be ill again." So he sent the Lord High Chamberlain away and called the royal wizard. "We must hide the moon," said the king, "so that the Princess Lenore will not see it when it shines in the sky tonight. How are we going to do that?" The royal wizard stood on his hand, and then he stood on his head, and then he stood on his feet again. "I know what we can do," he said. "We can stretch some black velvet curtains on poles. The curtains will cover all the palace gardens like a circus tent, and the Princess Lenore will not be able to see through them, so she will not see the moon in the sky." The king was so angry this time that he waved his arms around. "Black velvet curtains would keep out the air," he said. "The Princess Lenore would not be able to breathe, and she would be ill again." So he sent the royal wizard away and summoned the royal mathematician. We must do something, said the king, so that the Princess Lenore will not see the moon when it shines in the sky tonight. If you know so much, figure out a way to do that. The royal mathematician walked around in a circle, and then he walked around in a square, and then he stood still.
I have it,
he said. We can set off fireworks in the gardens every night. We will make a lot of silver fountains and golden cascades, and when they go off, they will fill the sky with so many sparks that it will be as light as day, and the Princess Lenore will not be able to see the moon. The king flew into such a rage that he began jumping up and down. Fireworks would keep the Princess Lenore awake, he said. She would not get any sleep at all, and she would be ill again. So the king sent the royal mathematician away. When he looked up again, it was dark outside, and he saw the bright rim of the moon just peeping over the horizon. He jumped up in a great fright and rang for the court jester. The court jester came bounding into the room and sat down at the foot of the throne. What can I do for you, your majesty? He asked. Nobody can do anything for me, said the king mournfully. The moon is coming up again. It will shine into the Princess Lenore's bedroom, and she will know it is still in the sky, and that she does not wear it on a golden chain around her neck. Play me something on your lute, something very sad, for when the princess sees the moon, she will be ill again. The court jester strummed on his lute. What do your wise men say? He asked. They can think of no way to hide the moon that will not make the Princess Lenore ill, said the king. The court jester played another song very softly. Your wise men know everything, he said. If they cannot hide the moon, then it cannot be hidden. The king put his head in his hands again and sighed. Suddenly, he jumped up from his throne and pointed to the windows. Look, he cried. The moon is already shining into Princess Lenore's bedroom. Who can explain how the moon can be shining in the sky when it's hanging on a golden chain around her neck? The court jester stopped playing on his lute. Who could explain how to get the moon when your wise men said it was too large and too far away? It was the Princess Lenore. Therefore, the Princess Lenore is wiser than your wise men and knows more about the moon than they do. So I will ask her. And before the king could stop him, the court jester slipped quietly out of the throne room and up the wide marble staircase to the Princess Lenore's bedroom. The princess was lying in bed, but she was wide awake, and she was looking out the window at the moon shining in the sky. Shining in her hand was the moon the court jester had got for her. He looked very sad, and there seemed to be tears in his eyes. Tell me, Princess Lenore, he said mournfully, how can the moon be shining in the sky when it is hanging on a golden chain around your neck? The princess looked at him and laughed. That's easy, silly, she said. When I lose a tooth, a new one grows in its place, doesn't it? Of course, said the court jester. And when the unicorn loses his horn in the forest, a new one grows in the middle of his forehead. That is right, said the princess. And when the royal gardener cuts the flowers in the garden, other flowers come to take their place. I should have thought of that, said the court jester, for it is the same way with the daylight. And it's the same way with the moon, said the Princess Lenore. I guess it's the same way with everything. Her voice became very low and faded away, and the court jester saw that she was asleep. Gently he tucked the covers in around the sleeping princess. But before he left the room, he went over to the window and winked at the moon, for it seemed to the court jester that the moon had winked at him. You've been listening to a story from the book Many Moons by James Thurber, published by Harcourt Brace and Company of New York. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Canella, and I'm Bill McDermott.
And now, it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Jean Smell Stevens. Today I'll be reading from the book English Fairy Tales by Joseph Jacobs and the Arthur Rackham Fairy Book. Molly Whoopi. Once upon a time there was a man and the wife had too many children, and they could not get meat for them, so they took the three youngest and left them in the woods. They traveled and traveled, and could see never a house. It began to be dark, and they were hungry. At last they saw a light and made for it. It turned out to be a house. They knocked at the door, and a woman came to it who said, "What do you want?" They said, "Please let us in and give us something to eat." The woman said, "I can't do that, as my man is a giant, and he would kill you if he comes home." They begged hard. "Let us stop for a little while," said they, "and we will go away before he comes." So she took them in and set them down before the fire, and gave them milk and bread. But just as they had begun to eat, a great knock came to the door, and a dreadful voice said, "These five souls from, I smell the blood of some earthly one." "Who have you there, wife?" "Eh," said the wife, "it's three poor lassies, cold and hungry, and they will go away. You won't touch them, man." He said nothing, but ate up a big supper, and ordered them to stay all night. Now he had three lassies of his own, and they were to sleep in the same bed with the three strangers. The youngest of the three strange lassies was called Molly Whoopi, and she was very clever. She noticed that before they went to bed, the giant put straw ropes round her neck and her sister's, and round his own lassie's neck he put gold chains. So Molly took care and did not fall asleep, but waited till she was sure everyone was sleeping sound. Then she slipped out of the bed and took the straw ropes off her own and her sister's neck, and took the gold chains off the giant's lassies. She then put the straw ropes on the giant's lassies, and the gold on herself and her sister's, and lay down. And in the middle of the night, up rose the giant, armed with a great club, and felt for the next with the straw. It was dark. He took his own lassies out of bed onto the floor, and batted them till they were dead, and then lay down again, thinking he had managed finally. Molly thought at times she and the sisters were off and away, so she wakened them and told them to be quiet, and they slipped out of the house. They all got out safe, and they ran and ran and never stopped until morning, when they saw a grand house before them. It turned out to be a king's house. So Molly went in and told her story to the king. He said, "Well, Molly, you are a clever girl, and you have managed well. But if you would manage better, and go back and steal the giant sword that hangs on the back of his bed, I would give your elder sister my elder son to marry." Molly said she would try. So she went back and managed to slip into the giant's house and crept in below the bed. The giant came home and ate up a great supper and went to bed. Molly waited until he was snoring, and she crept out and reached over the giant and got down the sword. But just as she got it out over the bed, it gave a rattle, and up jumped the giant, and Molly ran out at the door and the sword with her. And she ran, and she ran, and she ran, and she ran, until they came to the bridge of a single hair. And over it Molly skipped. But over it the giant could not, because he was too big and heavy. And he shook his fist and yelled at her, "Woe betide you, Molly Whoopi, if you ever come back again." And she said, "Twice more, I think I shall, if it so pleases me." So Molly took the sword to the king, and her sister was married to his son. "Well," the king said, "you've managed well, Molly, but if you would manage better and steal the purse that lies below the giant's pillow, I would marry your second sister to my second son." And Molly said she would try. So she set out for the giant's house and slipped in and hid again below the bed and waited until the giant had eaten his supper and was snoring sound asleep. She slipped out and slipped her hand below the pillow and got at the purse. But just as she was going out, the giant wakened and ran after her. And she ran, and she ran, and she ran, and she ran, until they came to the bridge of a single hair. And over it Molly skipped. but the giant could not because he was too big and heavy. And he shook his fist at her and yelled, "Woe betide you, Molly Whoppy, if you ever come back again." "Once more, I think I shall, if it so pleases me." So Molly took the purse to the king, and her second sister was married to the second son. After that, the king says to Molly, "Molly, you are a clever girl, but if you would do better yet, and steal the giant's ring that he wears on his finger, I will give you my youngest son for yourself." Molly said she would try. So back she goes to the giant's house and hides herself below the bed. The giant wasn't long ere he came home, and after he had eaten a great big supper, he went to his bed and shortly was snoring loud. Molly crept out and reached over the bed and got hold of the giant's hand. And she pulled and she pulled until she got off the ring. But just as she got it off, the giant got up and gripped her by the hand, and he said, "Now I have caught you, Molly Whoppy, and if I had done as much ill to you as you have done to me, what would you do to me?" Molly says, "I would put you into a sack, and I'd put the cat inside with you, and the dog beside you, and the needle and thread in the shears, and I'd hang you up upon the wall, and I'd go to the wood and choose the thickest stick I could get, and I would come home and take you down and bang you till you were dead." "Well, Molly," says the giant, "I'll do just that to you." So he gets a sack and puts Molly into it, and the cat and the dog beside her, and a needle and thread and shears, and hangs her up upon the wall and goes to the wood to choose a stick. And Molly, she thinks out, "Oh, if you could see what I see." "Oh," says the giant's wife, "what do you see, Molly?" But Molly never said a word, but, "Oh, if you saw what I see." The giant's wife begged that Molly would take her up into the sack so she would see what Molly saw. So Molly took the shears and cut a hole in the sack and took out the needle and thread with her and jumped down and helped the giant's wife up into the sack and sewed up the hole. The giant's wife saw nothing and began to ask to get down again. But Molly never minded, but hid herself at the back of the door. Home came the giant and a great big tree in his hand, and he took down the sack and began to batter it. His wife cried, "It's me, man, hold off!" But the dog barked, and the cat meowed, and he didn't know his wife's voice. But Molly came out from the back of the door, and the giant saw her, and he ran after her. And he ran, and she ran, and he ran, and she ran, until they came to the bridge of a single hill. And over it Molly skipped, but the giant could not, because he was too big and heavy. And he shook his fist and yelled at her, "Woe betide you, Molly Whoppy, if you ever come back again." "Never more shall I come again, if it so pleases me." So Molly took the ring to the king, and she was married to his youngest son, and she never saw the giant again. Puss in Boots. A miller who was dying divided all his property between his three children. This was a very simple matter, as he had nothing to leave but his mill, his donkey, and his cat. So he made no will and called in no lawyer, for he would probably have taken a large slice out of these poor possessions. The eldest son took the mill, the second the donkey, while the third was obliged to content himself with the cat, at which he grumbled very much. "My brother," said he, "by putting their property together may gain an honest livelihood, but there is nothing left for me except to die of hunger, unless indeed I were to kill my cat and eat him, and make a coat out of his skin which would be very scanty clothing." The cat, who heard the young man talking to himself, looked at him with a grave and wise air and said, "Master, I think you had better not kill me. I shall be much more useful to you alive." "How so?" asked his master. "You have but to give me a sack and a pair of boots such as gentlemen wear when they go shooting, and you will find you are not so ill off as you suppose." Now, though the young miller did not put much faith in the cat's words, he thought it rather surprising that a cat should speak at all, and he had before now seen him show so much cleverness in catching rats and mice that it seemed well to trust him a little further, especially as, poor young fellow, he had nobody else to trust. When the cat got his boots, he drew them on with a grand air. Then, slinging his sack over his shoulder and drawing the cords of it around his neck, he marched bravely to a rabbit warren hard by, with which he was well acquainted. Putting some bran and lettuce into his bag, and stretching himself out beside it as if he were dead, he waited for some fine, fat, young rabbit to peer into the sack to eat the food that was inside. This happened very shortly, for there are plenty of foolish young rabbits at every warren. And when one of them, who really was a splendid fat fellow, put his head inside, Master Puss drew the cords immediately and took him and killed him without mercy. Then, very proud of his prey, he marched direct up to the palace and begged to speak with the king. He was desired to ascend to the apartment of his majesty, where, making a low bow, he said, "Sire, here is a magnificent rabbit from the warren of my lord the Marquis of Carabas, which he has desired me to offer humbly to your majesty." "Tell your master," replied the king, "that I accept his present, and am very much obliged to him." Another time Puss went and hid himself in a sack in a wheat field, and there caught two splendid fat partridges, in the same manner as he had done the rabbit. When he presented them to the king, with a similar message as before, his majesty was so pleased that he ordered the cat to be taken down into the kitchen and given something to eat and drink. One day, hearing that the king was intending to take a drive by the river with his daughter, the most beautiful princess in the world, Puss said to his master, "Sir, if you would only follow my advice, your fortune is made. You have only to go and bathe in the river at the place which I shall show you, and leave all the rest to me. Only remember that you are no longer yourself, but my lord, the Marquis of Carabas." The miller's son agreed, not that he had any faith in the cat's promise, but because he no longer cared what happened. While he was bathing, the king and all the court passed by and were startled to hear loud cries of, "Help! Help! My lord, the Marquis of Carabas, is drowning!" The king put his head out of the carriage and saw nobody but the cat, who had at different times brought him so many presents of game. However, he ordered his guards to go quickly to the help of my lord, the Marquis of Carabas. While they were pulling the unfortunate Marquis out of the water, the cat came up bowing to the side of the king's carriage and told a long and pitiful story about some thieves who, while his master was bathing, had come and carried away all his clothes, so that it would be impossible for him to appear before his majesty and the illustrious princess. "Oh, we will soon remedy that," answered the king kindly, and immediately ordered one of the first officers of the household to ride back to the palace with all speed and bring back the most elegant supply of clothes for the young gentleman, who kept in the background until they arrived. Then, being handsome and well-made, his new clothes became him so well that he looked as if he had been a marquis all his days, and advanced with an air of respectful ease to offer his thanks to his majesty. The king received him courteously, and the princess admired him very much. Indeed, so charming did he appear to her that she persuaded her father to invite him into the carriage with them, which, you may be sure, the young man did not refuse. The cat, delighted at the success of his scheme, went away as fast as he could, and ran so swiftly that he kept a long way ahead of the royal carriage. He went on and on till he came to some peasants who were mowing in a meadow. "Good people," he said in a very firm voice, "the king is coming past here shortly, and if you do not say that the field you are mowing belongs to my lord the Marquis of Carabas, you shall all be chopped as small as mincemeat." So when the king drove by and asked whose meadow it was where there was such a splendid crop of hay, the mowers all answered in trembling tones that it belonged to my lord, the Marquis of Carabas. "You have very fine land, Marquis," said his majesty to the miller's son. "Yes, sire," he answered, "it is not a bad meadow, take it all together." Then the cat came to a wheat field, where the reapers were reaping with all their might. He bounced in upon them. "The king is coming past today, and if you do not tell him that this wheat belongs to my lord, the Marquis of Carabas, I will have you every one chopped as small as mincemeat." The reapers, very much alarmed, did as they were told, and the king congratulated the Marquis upon possessing such beautiful fields, laden with such an abundant harvest. They drove on, the cat always running before and saying the same thing to everybody he met, that they were to declare the whole country belonged to his master, so that even the king was astonished at the vast estate of my lord, the Marquis of Carabas. But now the cat arrived at a great castle, where dwelt an ogre, to whom belonged all the land through which the king had been passing. He was a cruel tyrant, and his tenants and servants were terribly afraid of him. This accounted for their being so ready to say whatever they were told to say by the cat, who had taken pains to find out all about the ogre. So, putting on the boldest face he could assume, Puss marched up to the castle with his boots on, and asked to see the owner of it, saying that he was on his travels, but did not wish to pass so near the castle of such a noble gentleman without paying his respects to him. When the ogre heard his message, he went to the door, received the cat as civilly as an ogre can, and begged him to walk in and repose himself. "Thank you, sir," said the cat, "but first I hope you will satisfy a traveler's curiosity. I have heard in far countries of your many remarkable qualities, and especially how you have the power to change yourself into any sort of beast you choose. A lion, for instance, or an elephant." "That is quite true," replied the ogre, "and lest you should doubt it, I will immediately become a lion." He did so, and the cat was so frightened that he sprang up to the roof of the castle and hid himself in the gutter, a proceeding rather inconvenient on account of his boots, which were not exactly fitted to walking with upon tiles. At length, perceiving that the ogre had resumed his original form, he came down again stealthily, and confessed that he had been very much frightened. "But, sir," said he, "it may be easy enough for such a big gentleman as you to change himself into a large animal. I do not suppose you can become a small one, a rat or a mouse, for instance. I have heard that you can. Still, for my part, I consider it quite impossible." "Impossible!" cried the other indignantly. "And you shall see." And immediately the cat saw the ogre no longer, but a little mouse running along the floor. This was exactly what he wanted, and he did the most natural thing a cat could do in the circumstances. He sprang upon the mouse and gobbled it up in a trice. So there was an end of the ogre. By this time the king had arrived opposite the castle, and was seized with a strong desire to enter it. The cat, hearing the noise of the carriage wheels, ran forward in a great hurry, and standing at the gate, said in a loud voice, "Welcome, sire, to the castle of my lord, the Marquis of Carabas." "What?" cried his majesty, very much surprised. "Does the castle also belong to you?" "Truly, Marquis, you have kept your secret well up to the last minute. I have never seen anything finer than this courtyard and these battlements. Indeed, I have nothing like them in the whole of my dominions." The Marquis, without speaking, helped the princess to descend, and standing aside that the king might enter first, for he had already acquired all the manners of the court, followed his majesty to the great hall, where a magnificent collation had been spread for the ogre and some of his friends. Without more delay, they all sat down to feast. The king, charmed with the good qualities of the Marquis of Carabas, and likewise his wine, of which he had drunk 6 or 7 cups, said, bowing across the table at which the princess and the miller's son were talking very confidentially together, "It rests with you, Marquis, whether you will not become my son-in-law." "I shall be only too happy," said the Marquis, very readily, and the princess's eyes declared the same. So they were married the very next day, and took possession of the ogre's castle, and of everything that had belonged to him. As for the cat, he became at once a grand personage, and had never any more need to run after mice, except for his own amusement. You've been listening to stories from the book English Fairy Tales by Joseph Jacob, published by Dover Books, and the Arthur Rackham Fairy Book, published by Harper & Row. Northern Storytellers is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Canella. And I'm Jean Pinnell Stevens.